getting to know the movers and shakers of Wisconsin.
Our conversation this weekend with Commissioner Emeritus Bud Selig.
A lot of people, Mr. Mayor, know that you've been mayor for a while. They know that you were a U.S. congressman before that, but they don't know a lot about Tom Barrett.
One conversation at a time.
I want to make sure that everyone is a part of that success, that everyone's a part of that prosperity.
What we want to see and what we expect to see is that group of players around which we can build grow.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Good morning. I'm Belinda Babinick. I'm your host this morning. I sat down this week with Alana Khan from the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. We talk about many things, including her time living in Israel, to race relations, to what she thinks about President Trump. First up, let's get to know Alana Khan. So I want to start by just finding out more about you. Where are you from?
I'm from Milwaukee. I grew up in Bayside. So I'm from the Milwaukee area. I grew up in Bayside, and then when I was 11, moved to Salt Lake City, Utah for my father's business. Then at 17, my parents moved back to Milwaukee, and I went forth into the world. I went to Boston. I went to college in Boston. I spent a year in Israel during college. I lived in San Francisco. And then I've lived in Israel. I lived in Israel for altogether about 8 years and have been back in Milwaukee for 16 years.
What is it like living in Israel?
I am Jewish, and I grew up in a home where there was a very strong connection to Israel and strong ties to Israel. My parents talked about Israel a lot at home. They were alive for the formation, the miracle of the formation of the state, of the founding of the state in 1948. And to them, it was a miracle. There were people who were literally rescued by there being a state where Jews were safe. So it was always, I was educated to care about Israel. And then when I went to Israel when I was 16, I went on a teen trip. I felt something, enough so that I decided to go back for a year of college. And that's when I, like all of sort of the pieces of being Jewish made sense to me, as in being Jewish is about being part of a people. In some ways, much more about belonging to the people and all of the things that the people does than about, you know, going to the synagogue, which is, you know, which is a thing too, which is an essential piece too. But for me, like being in Israel made all of it make sense. I spoke to a group the other day, and this came up, so this is sort of on the top of my head, and somebody asked me to, because I mentioned that, like being, for me, my personal connection to Israel, when I went, that it somehow being all the pieces fit together in a way that resonated for me differently. And so she asked me, like, tell me more about that. And I told her about the experience. There is something that happens on Memorial Day, when Israeli Memorial Day, Remembrance Day, when you remember the people, soldiers and people who have died for the country, like we, you know, we have one of those, and also Holocaust Memorial Day. There is something that happens. There's a siren that is sounded throughout the country, and everything stops. The highways stop. Cars on the highway stop where they are. Like the first time I saw it, and every time since, it's amazing. People get out of their cars, no matter where they are. They'll be in the middle of a meeting at work, and everybody will stand up and be silent for this moment of silence in which the sirens are sounded, not for war or, you know, tornadoes like we would be used to hearing them here, but as this sort of, you know, this shared memory and shared expression of values, like these are the things we value together, and just a connection to each other. It's incredibly powerful. And then there's real life. Okay, so I moved there, and I got married there and built a house there and had children there. And then it's real life, you know, and it's great and it's exhausting and it's mundane and all the stuff that real life is. And, you know, knew a lot of different people and had new Arabs and Jews. The preschool where my kids were had Arabs and Jews together. And, you know, it's real life.
Coming up next on WTMJ Conversations.
I think it's a really hard job. I think it's really hard.
I ask Alana Khan what she thinks of the media today.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Belinda Babinick, chatting this week with Alana Khan from the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. Alana is an award-winning writer and editor. I asked her what she thinks of today's media.
I think it's a really hard job. I think it's really hard. I think that the internet has been an amazing an evolving invention, right? This way that we, that this democratization of knowledge and information, and the people have all the, people have access to report, and it's wonderful, and it means everything is real time, right? You, and of course, as a professional journalist, professional journalists like think a lot about the craft and don't have the time to often to think carefully about the work they're doing. I think that it's, I think there's, well, you know, there are people who think much more about this than I, but I think that it's, there's danger. There's great danger. I don't know. One of the things that I worry about, and I think that we're seeing this with our president and the way he's been communicating about white supremacists, is that there's this sort of neutrality about things that we shouldn't be neutral about, and we weren't neutral about. And I think some of the way that information sharing has changed has allowed for that too. Like everything is of equal value. No, actually not everything is of equal value. We reject hatred. We reject Nazism. We reject white supremacy.
Do you feel like anti-Semitism is on the rise in the U.S.? Is this new? We're seeing Charlottesville play out.
There's an interesting paradox because on the one hand, it has never been so good to be Jewish anywhere than in America now. It is, I mean, I grew up the granddaughter of immigrants. All of my grandparents, actually one of my grandparents came, her family got here right before she was born. But all the other three all came to America, were born somewhere else and came here, were born in Eastern Europe. My father particularly talked about the anti-Semitism that he faced living on the west side of Milwaukee, you know, getting beat up, called kike, things like that. And we know that also when my parents came up, there were neighborhoods where Jews couldn't live, clubs Jews couldn't belong to. I mean, it's like African Americans. They would say no blacks or no dogs, blacks or Jews, right? Those were the signs. There were, I mean, there still, I think, are country clubs in Milwaukee that it's, you know, de facto Jews don't belong there. Like they're not totally welcome. But I digress. It was overt then. There's a prominent lawyer who talks about when he went to law school, there were areas of law that where Jews didn't work and couldn't work, and so that. There is a reason that there were so many Jews who went into personal injury law. That, if you notice, that's one of the fields where a lot of Jewish attorneys of the older generation worked. So the world has opened up. I grew up knowing, believing that I could go to any college that I wanted to go to. I could choose any field of study, any profession. There were places I didn't want to go. I wouldn't put myself, because it doesn't feel like a friendly place, but pretty much the world is open to me. And I think that's, you know, that's my personal experience, but we also know that it's true. There is less anti-Semitism now than there was 40 years ago, absolutely, 60 years ago in this country. And we also see in surveys that Americans' feelings toward Jews are very positive. It's true. On the other hand, anti-Semitism is dramatically rising in Europe. And we see, and I one of the things I do is that I monitor and respond to anti-Semitism. Like that's where the anti-Semitism office of Milwaukee. So we have an audit. We keep an audit every year. So we have seen an increase, a dramatic increase in the last few years of anti-Semitic incidents that are being reported. The thing, it'll go up with world events and then go down. And then I think the third thing, so when things happen in the world, we see them reflected by an increase in incidents here. We know that when there is financial insecurity, anti-Semitism increases. Anti-Semitic incidents is true because people need to blame somebody. And I think that what we saw in Charlottesville points to, it'll be interesting to see the data on this. If there actually are more white supremacists now than there were before. We know that there are more groups than there were, but are there more haters or are they more organized and bolder? And I'm not sure. I really believe that most people, I feel like Anne Frank, like most people are good at heart. And I think that I don't want to live in a world where I have to look through a filter of danger and suspicion. There is hatred and there is anti-Semitism. We've seen an increase in reports, but we've also seen an increase of people saying, nuh-uh, this is not us. I am getting, there is an increase in reports. I'm daily hearing about more swastikas, more Nazi flags, kids being bullied, kids, parents pulling their kids out of school because it feels like an unfriendly place, or their kids are, you know, hear hateful things.
Do you think President Trump is responsible?
Yeah. I have to tell you that 3 months ago, I wouldn't have said it so clearly, but thing after thing after thing during his campaign, and this is not a partisan comment, but during the campaign, the embrace of violence that he communicated, you know, go ahead, at his rally, you know, go ahead, beat him up. He talked about people being taken out in stretchers, and the sort of the permission that he gave to people. And we saw people at his rallies, you know, saying, yelling, go back to Auschwitz. And there were overt anti-Semitic things, something about, I remember there was something about, you know, the Jew media or something. It was hateful toward all sorts of people, and he didn't call it out. And that, you know what, it's his responsibility. And then at Holocaust Remembrance Day, and there's the UN Holocaust Remembrance Day in January, in which he talked about the Holocaust and didn't mention the Jews. And during his inauguration, he talked about America First, as I recall, which is language that we heard during World War II that was an answer for why the U.S. didn't step in and help the Jews who were facing genocide in Europe. And people said to him, you know, that language is problematic for us. This is how it sounds to us Jews. And he kept using it. Before that, I would have said, you know, we've seen a rise and we can make the connection. But now, after how he communicated this week and expressed an equivalency between white supremacists and Nazis and then people who are opposed to their hatred is completely unacceptable. Completely unacceptable. Like, we have shared values in this country. There is a way that we behaved. There was, you know, the U.S. was on a certain side during World War II. I saw a World War II soldier talking in, there's a town, Mosinee, where somebody, there's a Nazi flag somebody had hanging outside their house. And they interviewed this World War II veteran who was completely appalled by it. Because he fought for the values of this country, which are opposed to Nazism. And there's this flag, and it means something. It means something about the value of people. It's absolutely totally racist. It's absolutely totally hateful. And we, America, is opposed to that. Like, there is free speech, free thought, believe what you want. But we do have shared values. That's a bad thing. And the conversation about Confederate symbols, Confederate statues, is a very worthwhile conversation to have because we rejected slavery. That's a value. Our country today rejects slavery. And so not all ideas and values are equal. And yes, everybody gets to communicate. And I believe that the white supremacists had the freedom to rally. But I think that the boldness, that they felt free to take off their hoods and to show their faces because there is no... And to behave with impunity, that there's no negative effect, that this is a totally acceptable set of things to say, that it's okay to talk about President Trump's son-in-law in an anti-Semitic way, so that it's okay to talk about what did that guy say? You know, the commie Jew mayor of Charlottesville and the, you know, N-word deputy mayor, like, ew, unacceptable. So, yeah, I think that our president has failed us in moral leadership when it comes to communicating about these. And I think about these things, and I think it's important. And I think we need to demand better and clearer moral leadership.
Coming up next on WTMJ Conversations.
We have a responsibility to condemn, to stand loudly, clearly, strongly against hatred.
I ask Alana Khan about Charlottesville and how she would explain what happened to kids.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Belinda Babinick, your host this week. As the images of Charlottesville continue to burn brightly in the minds of Americans, it's a time race relations in this country need to be talked about. How did you talk to your kids about Charlottesville?
There is hatefulness in the world, and there are people who... Okay, my youngest child is 17. So let's imagine that I have a 10-year-old. There are people who are hateful, and there are people who are racist. There are people who are anti-Semitic. Like, it's true. That's a thing. And we have a responsibility. Actually, what I have been saying is that we have a responsibility to stand loudly, clearly, strongly against hatred, to condemn it, to call it out, to not let it proliferate, and then to fill up the world and to fill up the empty spaces between us with compassion and empathy and knowing each other. And that's our job, too. Our job isn't to live always in the negative and the defensive and the fearful. It's to call it out. It can't be allowed to proliferate. You got to call out the bully at school. But then you have to go on and have positive relationships and be the kind of, you know, reflect the kind of world you want to live in. And we have the luxury of living in a country where we're not in a constant state of war. We get to talk about, we get to use flowery language like that because it's to fill up the space between us with empathy and relationship. That matters. We're fortunate. We live in a great place, a great country with a very diverse population. And there's a great opportunity to know people who are different than we are. One of the projects that we started at the JCRC, at the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, is Hours Against Hate. And when we started it in 2013, it was, people loved the idea. We started it, actually, it was a State Department project, and we brought it to Milwaukee. And it is about pledging an hour to people who don't live, love, look, or pray. Who live, look, pray, and love differently than you do. So it's about knowing people who are different than we are. And that's a totally wonderful American message because we live in this country of immigrants and with Native people. And we, like, what a totally great opportunity to know each other. And I think especially in Milwaukee, we live in this extremely segregated city. We have the opportunity to fill in the space. We have a lot of space between our communities and within our communities. What happens if we fill in that space with acts of goodwill, with knowing people? You know, I feel like my visual is like fibers between cells. It's not a thing, but like fibers between us that don't create space, that fill up the space that could be taken by hatred. And instead, they're filled by the fibers of relationship.
Coming up next on WTMJ Conversations.
The Milwaukee Jewish community is a pretty tight-knit, connected community.
Milwaukee has a rich Jewish history. I got a chance to sit down with Alana Khan from the Milwaukee Jewish Federation to talk about it.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Good morning. I'm Belinda Babinick, your host this week. I'm talking to Alana Khan from the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. Milwaukee has a very diverse history, and no one knows that better than Ms. Khan.
Talk to me about Milwaukee's Jewish history. Do we have a rich Jewish history in this city?
We do. Okay, aside from Golda Meir, who went on to become the Prime Minister of Israel, and she's from Milwaukee. And there's another, you know, a school named after her and a library named after her. But we have this is, Milwaukee Jewish community is a pretty tight-knit, connected community that has remained pretty stable in numbers. And also there are Jews involved with very deeply with all different parts of the community. We have a great Jewish museum, by the way, which is really worth a visit. And there's an exhibit there right now, an Adolf Rosenblatt, who died this within the last year. But there's an exhibit of his sculpture and painting that is wonderful. He was an East Side artist from this very creative family. The Jewish community in Milwaukee, there are Jews involved in all different aspects of life in Milwaukee, totally, really well integrated in the city, and also, it's a microcosm of the American Jewish experience altogether, right? The community started in the city, and we still see remnants of it. We still see there's a Jewish community, and there's a synagogue and a Jewish neighborhood in Sherman Park. There is a synagogue on the east side of Milwaukee, used to be two, and then most of the synagogues are in the North Shore. We also have Jewish preschools, and we have three Jewish day schools, so elementary day schools. And I think there are three Jewish high schools. There is a whole, we have a, there's a Jewish social service agency that actually most of its clients are not Jewish. It was for many years a refugee resettlement agency, but it provides all sorts of social services, it's Jewish family services, including housing. And we have facilities for seniors. And then there are a lot of people who are Jewish and maybe not affiliated with any of the organizations, and that's part of the community too. I think that there's a diverse and robust community.
Do you think that fewer people in the U.S. are religious? Do you think we're losing religion in the U.S.?
It's so interesting. So I think it's funny because the Jewish people really, the Jewish immigrants, Jews really adapted themselves to living in America, whereas being Jewish, was, as I said, was really a much more about being connected with a people, and that included religious practices, but it really was much more about people. And coming to America as immigrants, Judaism or Jewish practice changed in as a reflection of how Christianity was practiced. So it became a very private practice at home or in synagogues. And then we saw the rise of these synagogues in the suburbs that often looked a lot like churches. And what we've seen, and it started, I would say, on the East Coast, and everything sort of, you know how it is with everything, with fashion, with everything, it all starts on the coast, and we're sort of slower. You know, we move more slowly, we think carefully. One of the things that's happened in Jewish life is it's the same thing that's happened in other religions, but it's the sort of do-it-yourself approach. I don't have to belong to a synagogue and pay my dues to a synagogue which supports a clergy or two and a building and a, you know, a school and all these programs. I can do it the way I want to do it. I can hire a rabbi who's going to perform this service for me, this particular service. I don't have to be part of community. And I, on the one hand, I think that there's a sort of an entrepreneurial, creative brilliance in it. I think it's, and in a way, I think that's where the world is going. I think there's some poverty in it, too, because there is something about being part of a community where everybody doesn't look like you. Like, you could be being part of a congregation with young people and old people, with people who, with your political thoughts and people who you disagree with. There's some value to being part of a more diverse community. But to get back to that point of the DIY, what I keep seeing is, I mean, I think people are hungry for meaning. And some of the people who leave the established institutions end up going and creating their own established institutions. They're just their own. They're just fashioned in their own image, which I think is natural. I think that's the way things evolve. Do I think people are coming less religious? Yeah. It'll be, I don't know. I think that actually it's like, you know, history's like, in some ways, it's like the flow of water. Like, it's going to find its way. It's going to find its path. So it'll be interesting to see what it looks like in 20 years. I do think that the old model, it doesn't work. I wrote a column that did not make me very many friends when I was editor of the Wisconsin Jewish Chronicle, but I wrote a column about how it was expensive to belong to a synagogue. It's expensive. And it is expensive. There are real expenses. I'm not blaming anybody for that. That's a thing. I belong to a synagogue, and I pay dues, and it's important to me. Just like, by the way, I pay taxes, and I'm happy to pay taxes because I like my garbage picked up, and I like there being police and all the other things we get with taxes. I like there being schools that are, you know, that care for our children or educate our children. So I wrote this column that was about how on the high holidays, we have the high holy days in the fall, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And there are others, but those are sort of the big ones that a lot of Jews who don't go to synagogue much throughout the year will still come to the synagogue for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And you have to have a ticket. To most synagogues, you have to have a ticket to get in. And so I wrote this column, and this is a long time ago. If I wrote it today, it would be different. But it was basically saying, this is the one time of the year that people want to come to synagogue. Like, we need to find a way to not have these barriers so that when people want, we can be the most welcoming. And Meaning, it means we need to find a different model. It doesn't mean that we, doesn't mean that synagogues shouldn't find a way to function financially. I mean, you need to have income if you're going to pay, you need to have revenue if you're going to pay your bills. But it means that the old model isn't working. And since then, not because of my column, but because of the world, all the synagogues have tried different things. They've had sort of pay as you can, or the first year for young people, younger people up to age 35 or whatever, it's $35 a year, for the first year or two. So all these synagogues are trying different models because, frankly, people are not joining as much. And I think we see that in every religion. I talk with faith leaders in other faith traditions, and everybody's seeing it. And on the other hand, evangelical churches are growing, and non-denominational churches are growing, because people still want meaning.
Coming up next on WTMJ Conversations.
There are people doing really good work. There are foundations that are funding really good work. There are so many organizations.
Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the U.S. I asked Alana Khan with the Milwaukee Jewish Federation what we can do to fix that.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Belinda Babinick, your host this week. I got the chance to sit down with Alana Khan from the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. Many people think segregation is something that happened a long time ago, but as Ms. Khan with the Milwaukee Jewish Federation explains, it's something that is still very relevant today.
You mentioned earlier about Milwaukee being such a segregated city. Mm. What do you think we can do to bridge the gap in Milwaukee? How can we come together as a community and as a city?
I've really thought about this so much, as have many people. There are people doing really good work. There are foundations that are funding really good work. There are so many organizations. Most of our elected officials are good people who became elected officials, who became public officials because they want to do good work. And somehow it is hard to move things forward in this city. There's a stuckness. There's a sense of, you know, too often you hear it's just not how we do things here. So what's the answer? Like, how do we connect all of these good projects and all these good efforts to actually reduce segregation, to increase our relationships with each other, to reduce black male incarceration, to reduce poverty, to increase the access to opportunities, and just the huge education gap and the huge gaps between the opportunities that my children have and the opportunities and the lack of opportunities that some other children have. So what do we do? I keep coming back. I really think it has to come from the top. I think that the city's trying. I think that the Office of Violence Prevention is going to be a very interesting case study. What I would like to see, I would love to see the mayor and the county executive come together and say, we have a set of very real challenges, and the people who live in Mequon and Germantown and Franklin and Greenfield and Oak Creek are all part of it. We need a regional approach. It's not just the city of Milwaukee. It's a whole regional approach. And we need to have a plan to decrease poverty, to decrease segregation, to increase access to opportunity. I think we have examples from other cities. If you look at the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, they did a study a few years ago that compared Milwaukee to all these other cities, like-sized cities. I think we have examples of what has worked in other places. And I'd like to see the mayor heading it with the county executive and say, these are the changes we want to see happen, and this is how we know we're doing it. This is how, and we're going to connect the services and the nonprofits and all and the faith community, all these different functions in our community that are working for the good. We're going to have goals, and we're going to check in to make sure that we reach these goals. I think it has to come from the top. That's what. I think there are so many good efforts, and we need from the top, we need a concerted, really dedicated, we need to see that there is a serious commitment to fixing the deep problems in this city. I think it's terrifying to think about the increase of poverty. Increase of poverty plus the decreasing quality of our public education. I think it just spells really bad things. And we have to be in crisis mode.
Coming up next on WTMJ Conversations.
We have to be compassionate with ourselves and with other people and to try to be empathetic. Most people are just doing their best.
What we can each do personally to end prejudice and hate.
WTMJ and WTMJ HD Milwaukee is News Radio 620 WTMJ.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Belinda Babinick, your host this week. Unfortunately, Milwaukee has the distinction of being one of the most segregated cities in the United States of America. I sat down and talked with Alana Khan about personal responsibility when it comes to race relations.
As far as people individually and personally who have prejudice and bias and misconceptions, what can we each do personally?
Well, I think we need to get to know the other as a rejection of the segregation and separation, which breeds hatred, right? If you don't know somebody, it's easier to hate them and to pin things on them that don't belong to them and to make generalizations. And then as soon as you actually meet that person, they disrupt some of that. So I think first we have to be in relationship with people, with the other, whoever the other is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's different based on who we are. I think we have to get out of our comfort zones. I think one thing is to go volunteer, volunteer somewhere, be part of, volunteer in a neighborhood that maybe you're uncomfortable with, but be part of something good. And the other thing I'd say is there are some great dialogue projects. The Zeidler Center does Zeidler Center for Public Conversation, discussion. The Interfaith Conference has these amazing faith dinners that provide us access to people that we wouldn't necessarily have access to. Provides us access to have relationships with people, to have conversations with people. And conversation, dialogue is action. It's action because we change our own hearts and minds, which then means we function differently in the world. And I think we have to educate our children. I think we have to call people out, especially people who are our friends and our neighbors and our family. When we hear them say hateful things or say intolerant or bigoted things, we have to be willing, especially for people who we feel are our friends or allies or loved ones, especially with them, because they might be able to hear us, right? I think with compassion and with love and with patience, we have to disrupt or interrupt bigotry. And I think we have to commit to being part of the solution. I do think that the process of increasing our own empathy or changing our hearts and minds or dismantling our own or questioning our own bigotry. Right? We all have biases. I mean, I think it's a natural human function to be biased because it's protective. That's how we protect ourselves. Right? We determine who is dangerous and then there are studies that show that it's a natural thing. Like I protect my village, and so I determine who is the other, and I'm going to protect myself from the other. But we human beings have the capacity to question those biases, right, and not allow them to sort of flower into an unreasonable or destructive bigotry or hatred. I think we have to be patient with each other and with ourselves, persistent, patient and compassionate, because I think that it is a process of, there is a process involved to changing your fundamental assumptions. I have a million examples in my own mind of things I didn't even know that I didn't understand. I didn't even know that I had these assumptions until I went, oh, I don't even see this other set of ideas because I'm so rooted in my own assumptions. But it's a process of understanding. You know, I remember when I used to think 20 years ago that I should never talk about race, that I was supposed to think that everybody was all the same, right? That whole sort of melting pot idea. And I remember I said something to somebody about, oh, I couldn't even, about how there was some high value in not noticing who was black and who was white and who was, different shades of brown. And she was like, are you kidding? That's ridiculous. Like, it's okay to notice that an African-American is an African-American. Like, that would be ridiculous to not notice that someone with European heritage looks a particular way. Like, that's fake. But I remember thinking, like, my mind sort of went, oh, that means that I get to acknowledge difference and I can be curious about what I don't know. And there are ways to communicate about that. But anyways, there are just, I think that we have our own minds, our own hearts, our own perceptions, our own analysis of our own perceptions is an evolving process. And we have to be compassionate with ourselves and with other people. And to try to be empathetic. Most people are just doing their best.
I want to thank Alana Khan from the Milwaukee Jewish Federation for joining me. I want to thank you for tuning in. We went over several things this week: the rise of anti-Semitism in the U.S., race relations, and how we can improve them, as well as Charlottesville. If you missed anything, then head to WTMJ.com or the WTMJ mobile app. I'm Belinda Babinick. This has been WTMJ Conversations.